Now I see where some people get their questions. Like, there was somebody asked me about changing the name of Stockton to Kingston Town. I see there was an article in there. Oh, that's very
nice. When are they going to do that?
Oh, they're not going to do that.
Tell me about the Tripmaster monkey. Apparently, the monkey is a formidable god in China. Tell me about that.
He's a mythic, legendary hero. And I think it's a story that goes back to pre-literate times. And people told his stories, sang the songs, and put on plays about a monkey who accompanied a religious saint. And they went west, looking for the route west. And in the Buddhist version, they arrive in India, and they find the sutras, and bring Buddhism to China. But in my book, he keeps going until he arrives in America in the 60s.
Now, how does the god relate to Whitman?
Well, I don't know whether the monkey is a god. He's a monkey, and he relates to Whitman in that Whitman has the spirit of the monkey, or the spirit of play and humor and chaos and revolution. All of that kind of spirit is in Whitman.
You really capture the feeling of San Francisco in the 1960s.
Good, yes, yes.
That's a remarkable image of the city. You can just see the city, one site after another, after another, after another.
Yeah, that's the way. This is a tour guide of San Francisco and the Bay Area, and I wanted to get that sense of the fog and what is it that's in the fog and Is there poetry in the fog? Is it hiding? Is the fog making us depressed so that hundreds of people jump off the bridge? I keep thinking that's why people jump off the bridge, because of the fog. So it's very easy to do atmosphere. Just keep bringing the fog in.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. Yeah. People jumping off bridges here and there's not too much fog.
Yeah. Well, this is the other end
Brooklyn of... Seems to be especially popular.
Oh, do they jump off that? I didn't know that. Maybe that's it's Land's End here and the Land's End at the other end. And so all of the people keep looking for the end of the rainbow or whatever. And I guess some of them get to the end and they see that they didn't find what they were looking for. Maybe that's what happens.
Now, in Tripmaster, monkeys just jam with dialogue. People talking about the books they've read, the movies they've seen up through, I guess, this is set in the very early 60s.
Yeah.
So this obviously was a formidable period in your life, wasn't it?
Yeah. I was, Whitman, I think, is exactly the same age as me, and so I was in my 20s during that time, and I think it's an amazing time to have been young, to have participated in the forming of the next era, and to have been the people who tried to put an end to the war in Vietnam.
Whitman is certainly Americanized. All the dialogue is purely American. You yourself, as a Chinese American, in a way, I guess you're torn between two cultures because you are first generation, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I understand in reading some of the publicity material that your parents did not speak English.
Well, my parents still don't speak English very well. I actually think they do speak English, but they don't know it. Somehow they communicate very well with English-speaking people. It's not well enough, so they don't think of themselves as English speakers. The one reason for writing this book is that I wanted to use the American language, especially the language of the 60s. I felt after writing the last two books that I was constantly translating Chinese into an English. I was trying to find an English that would simulate Chinese. And after I finished those two books, I still felt a need to use an American language that I use, that I love, a contemporary language. So this is what this book is also, my enjoyment of the current American slang and English.
How hard is it to grow up in a household where Chinese is predominantly spoken, whereas when you went to school or you went out to play in the streets, you heard English spoken all the time?
It was very, very hard. And
how could you separate out the two languages?
Oh, well, that's easy. That part is easy. The language that I knew and could communicate in was Chinese. And then there was this other language. Oh, there was this other way that people had that just left me out. I had a very hard struggle to, being a writer, and I think having been born with the soul of a writer, it was, I experienced all kinds of cultural shock and psychic trauma because I went out into the world and I couldn't communicate with the other children out there. So there was there were years of struggle and learning and fear and before I could finally get to English, which I did at about 7 years old.
So you spoke Chinese up until
Until the time I went to school. Yeah, only Chinese. And it seemed to be the only language I heard, too, because we didn't know other kinds of people.
So you lived in a Chinese community in Stockton, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So everybody you knew was Chinese, the language, the newspapers. So it was, in effect, we have that in New York. There's a huge Chinatown. People have no idea how to speak English, and they don't need to.
Mm-hmm.
There are several Chinese dailies, and there are theaters. The same is true in various Spanish communities. There are people. Mm-hmm. I was lined up to try to get out of jury duty.
Yes.
Some time ago, and there was a woman ahead of me with her son, and the son told the clerk, he said, "My mother doesn't speak English, so she's from Puerto Rico. She can't sit on a jury." And the clerk said, "Well, how long has your mother been in the United States?" And he said, 35 years.
Yes, yes. And I don't know, maybe some people just don't have the ear or the gift of language.
Or the need. If you grow up in a self-contained community,
right,
as you were doing in Stockton, or as many people do in Spanish Harlem, why bother?
Yeah, except that I know that I felt the need, and I know my parents did too, and because I guess another part of the soul of a writer is the immense curiosity, as a monkey has immense curiosity, and I just needed to get out into the larger world and to be able to communicate with the rest of the world, and I actually see that there's other people who have that too. One of the oldest ongoing programs in the various Chinese community organizations is English speaking classes, and those classes are always filled with immigrants and with people who've been here for years and years, and they go to these classes and they struggle with it and they learn, and a lot of the goals of the classes is citizenship, to take the tests in English. So there is a desire among people to get out into the larger community, to get out of the ghetto, and the way to do it is through language.
What do you think of these bills that would make English the official language?
I think those are terrible. I think they're terrible because those bills come out of paranoia. I mean, I've read the remarks of some of the people who've sponsored the bills, and they write about going into Chinatown or Asia Town, and I think they're scared. You know, they see the signs, they see that beautiful writing, and they feel excluded. They can't read it, and they think, well, the country is being taken over by these these others, and or they go somewhere and they hear Spanish. I read the article in Esquire where the person described so well of the fear of being among people who spoke Spanish, and instead of a healthy reaction which says, "I will just learn more. I will just learn more. I'll read these signs. I'll learn to speak to these people in Spanish." Some people will react by closing in and saying, "I insist on my English language." In The Woman Warrior, I write about an aunt who comes to America, and she's surrounded by Spanish-speaking people, and she gets paranoid. We all get that natural reaction. We think, we don't understand what they're talking about. Oh, I think maybe they're talking about me. They're laughing, and I think they're laughing at me. You know, we get that. We all get that when we're among people who speak differently. And then the aunt in the book goes completely paranoid because they think they're plotting against her. There are other ways. Another way is to let this new language in and learn it and be bilingual, trilingual. It's possible.
Well, it's certainly not necessary to make English the official language. It's virtually the world's official language.
It is the official language anyway, and I know why it is. English is it is such a wonderful plastic language in the sense that it can simulate anything. In trying to write a Chinese American language. In these books, or I try to write American English. I try to write American with a Chinese accent, or I translate the voices of Chinese speakers. And so, you know, sometimes when I write dialogue, I say it to myself in Chinese, and then I type it in English, trying to get the rhythms and the power and of Chinese into the English language. And the more I work, the more I realize what a wonderful language English is. You can simulate the rhythms of any other language. And I think it's no wonder that English is now the language that the world communicates in. It's the language that we can express anything in it. We can express... I don't believe those people who say, "Oh, well, there's no English word for such and such a word in another language." I think there is. English can translate anything.
Now, if we can't find it, we'll steal it.
And we'll invent it. We'll invent it. Yeah.
Now, a moment ago, you said that you were born with the soul of a writer, and how can this be? I mean, how is one born with the soul of a writer? Is this a fluke that someone has this artistic bent? Obviously, it doesn't happen to everyone. It happens to you.
Well, so part of it is fluke, and then part of it is being raised by a mother who is a constant storyteller, and then she is a part of a community of storytellers. And we had that laundry where people came and told one another stories and read letters, and then I also spent 17 years in Hawaii where talk story is part of being a person from those islands. And I don't know what I was born with and what I was born into, but there were stories around me all the time.
Yeah, it's very difficult to explain the artistic temperament, isn't it? Nobody, nobody knows exactly why somebody does it or wants to.
Mm-hmm. Part of it is having an ear, a curiosity. Yeah, I don't know. Here I write all these talk stories, and then I ask my brothers and sisters who were there when the stories were being told, and they say they didn't hear it. So then that makes a difference between me and them.
Well, you do have the soul of a writer.
Yeah.
Your first book, Woman Warrior, in 1976, I believe this won the National Book Critics Circle Award, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And certainly a very successful book. How did this come about?
You know, I started writing at about 8 years old, and when I learned English was when I started writing, and I know that at that age, when I was young, I tried to write those stories in The Woman Warrior and in Chinamen, and because I knew those stories already, and I knew those people, I wanted to write their adventures, and especially the explorations, the ship voyages by the men, and I tried to write them. I remember when I was 10, 12, I would write them over and over again, but I was just a kid. I didn't have the vocabulary and I didn't have the form, so I wrote these kid stories, but they weren't big enough, they weren't strong enough, and I read Jason and the Argonauts as a kid, and then so I tried that. I tried to write about those men in those terms and with that rhythm and with the Greek hexameter couplets, and that didn't work. And so what I did was over and over again try to approach these stories, and I finally did it when I was around 35. So that's how they came about, by trying it over and over again with new and more wisdom and craft.
Well, two earlier books are deemed nonfiction or memoirs, but I have a feeling there's a great deal of, you're talking about storytelling, a great deal of fiction in
it. Oh, yes, yes. Especially when the people I wrote about have such powerful imaginations. They have the minds of fiction writers, even though they're real people. So I had to work out a form in which I could write about real people who talk about dreams and visions and legends and stories.
So when you began work on Tripmaster Monkey, it wasn't that much different than the earlier books, was it?
No, it's not that much different, except that Witmanaw Singh and Tanya and Nancy and Grandma and all those people in the book, they aren't real. So that's the difference. I made up those people. And it's strange. The more made up the people are, the more realistic I had to make their world, so that I made sure they drove the right kind of car and wore the right kind of costumes. And when they were in a certain street, I had to make sure that that street actually crossed another street. I had a lot of fun picking out the cars for them. And it was almost like I went shopping for and gave everybody a car and an apartment and things to do.
Now, you, like Whitman, are a graduate of Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Were you caught up with the student rebellion in Berkeley?
Oh, sure. I was on the picket line at the FSM, and I was in the Greek theater with Mario Savio, and I know that I was on the first march against the war in Vietnam, and that was Women for Peace, and we marched. There were just a few of us, and we went sort of around and around on Shattuck Avenue, pushing baby carriages with peace signs on them.
Stanley Carnot, who did a series for PBS on the Vietnam War and published a huge book about the history of the war, theorizes that the war was extended as a result of these student protests, that hardened the mentalities of both sides and led to a prolongation of the war. What is your...
Oh, I think that's such a despairing idea.
What's that?
That idea is so full of despair.
Yeah.
Because when there is a war, any kind of a war, any war, including difficulties like segregation, when you are an ordinary citizen and human being, you must do something about it. So what can you do? You think of nonviolent actions, and you do them. Like Gandhi making up satyagrahas, he called them, and Martin Luther King sit-ins and so on.
But that period wasn't all nonviolent.
I know.
The radicals destroyed buildings and bombed people and killed
people. Well, that part is an extension of war. When you use violent techniques against violence, then yes, you do extend violence and war in the world. Maybe that's what he meant in his book, that when the demonstrations became violent, then we were making mistakes. And then we were not being strong in the nonviolence.
Because no one can speak with one voice.
What was that?
You can't speak with one voice when you're dealing with millions of people.
That's true.
So obviously there are going to be fringe groups and radical groups and pacifists.
Yes.
Just a variety of people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tripmaster Monkey is very much a novel of the 1960s.
Yes.
How do you reconcile the person you are today with your life as a person in the 1960s?
I am pretty much an extension of the person in the 60s. Throughout the 60s, I was very strong in my nonviolence, and I knew very well that I decided that I was not going to go to jail and I was not going to get arrested, and I would get out of the demonstrations before the tear gas came toward me, and I would get out of the way. I am not one of those people who runs around now feeling guilty because I didn't do enough. I mean, when you give yourself, when you give something your best shot, you have no regrets. And I think that I was very strong in my nonviolence. When we went to Hawaii, I saw the war more clearly than other people because in Berkeley it was still abstract. In Hawaii, you saw the ships with missiles on them. You saw the soldiers all wounded at the beach on R&R. You saw the tanks going around the island doing maneuvers. I mean that was very clearly the staging area for the war. And then I also saw like 10 Quakers doing a demonstration in front of one of the federal installations, and I joined them. And then in Hawaii also we had a sanctuary which extended the Hawaiian tradition of the city of refuge, which is in the Bible too. A city of refuge where a soldier could come, or somebody in a war could come, and then there was sanctuary. So we had a sanctuary at one of the churches for AWOL soldiers, and I think that I felt that I always carried out the pacifist techniques, and now I feel that I am more of a pacifist than ever, So I am an extension of that, and in this book I am saying, let's make up more pacifist techniques. There aren't enough, and I don't know enough of them. And I will put some of them in this fake book, and we can carry them out. But I'm not that strong, and I'm not that creative, and I can't do it by myself. So here are a few suggestions, and you think up some more. There are very few pacifist visions in this world. We haven't thought up what we're going to do with a peaceful world or what a peaceful world is. And this is why there's so much violence, because we're afraid that if we stop having all that excitement, which we are addicted to, then we will be bored. And we don't know. I think one reason we have so much war is we think that a peaceful world will be boring.
Do you miss the 60s, or are you satisfied with what we're doing in the 80s?
I don't miss the 60s because...
Not even a little nostalgic?
No. I love that paisley. I love paisley. I love the clothes. I love the hair. This is one reason I wear my hair like this, is because it's 60s hair. But I don't miss it in a real way, because the reason Woodstock and be-ins and love-ins were possible is because they are the opposite of the war. See, there was war energy, and and peace energy, and it was dichotomized. Everyone could feel, the people here could feel that we had a righteous cause because of the opposition to the war. I mean, everything that the Grateful Dead have, that people are, that the deadheads are nostalgic for, was made possible by a war. And I don't think that's right. We have to be able to figure out how we are going to have wonderful dances and music and party without a war to oppose.
Now, you left Oakland and went to Hawaii for many years, and you're back on the mainland now. Why did you come back? Not that you have to have a reason or justify it, but I mean...
No, there are lots of reasons. One of them is that Hawaii really is paradise, often when we were there, I was thinking, I'm Ulysses in the land of the lotus eaters, and I have to, I always felt like an outsider there, a howley.
Well, writers are always supposed to feel like they're outsiders, aren't they?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. No, but when I come back to Oakland and the Bay Area, I feel at home. I feel that those are my roots. And it could just be because I was born there, but I feel a reality in the Bay Area. And I feel roots. I feel that I can say we and speak for we Californians. And I never could feel like that in Hawaii. There is something, maybe it's the strength of the Hawaiians who kept making me feel guilty for being those people who rip off the land. And I kept feeling that they were saying, you've ripped off the land and now you're ripping off our stories. And I didn't want to be like that.
Are you living in San Francisco now?
In Oakland.
In Oakland now. Well, there are an awful lot of good writers that live in the San Francisco, Oakland area.
Yes.
Like Ishmael Reed and Herb Gold and Amy Tan. I just did an interview with Amy Tan. She wrote a wonderful book about Chinese mothers and daughters.
Joy Luck Club. Yes.
Yes. Have you read that?
No, but I've read two excerpts in various magazines. Yes, they look wonderful.
So you have a huge community of writers that all get together and party?
No, but we do see each other every once in a while. Last time I saw a bunch, including Herb Gold and Alice Walker and Alice Adams, and demonstration in support of Salman Rushdie, and it was at the San Francisco Public Library, and we read excerpts. And it was very disturbing in that the Muslims demonstrated outside with their prayer rugs, and they had a sign that said, blaspheming no, free speech yes. And I felt very torn because...
it's quite a contradiction, isn't it?
Yes, and it's a contradiction that we have to integrate. We have to make sense. We have to see. I felt that it was my task to figure out that contradiction. And also, I'm used to being the demonstrator on the outside, and I'm not used to being the person being picketed. So I've been thinking really hard about when I went into this demonstration, I realized that the Bill of Rights is a very important value for me, and that I'll risk a lot for the Bill of Rights. And then when I saw this idea of blasphemy now, I realized that when the Ten Commandments says that thou shalt not take the Lord's name in vain, or God's name in vain, and God is the Word, I think, oh, that's the commandment against blasphemy. And I believe that God is the Word, and I worship the Word, and I know that the Word is a way to get to God, to reach God. And so I was thinking, oh, this is what, is it possible to have the Bill of Rights and the Ten Commandments? We can't have both. They're entirely contradictory, and most Americans don't know that.
Well, Muslims in particular have let dogma dominate their art. And in the Western world, we have not done that. So everything they do is based on their religion. And here, I think we hold religion off to the side somehow.
But if we do that, we may also hold spirituality to the side. And
well, that's our choice.
And we really...
That's our choice, but it's not theirs. They don't have that choice, but we have it. We can hold it off to the side or in heaven envelop us.
Well, they
have... Muslims don't have that choice.
They have that choice if they take the choice.
That's risk their lives.
Yes.
If they repudiate what the Prophet says, they risk their lives.
Yes.
And that's what Salman Rushdie did,
mm-hmm.
and that's the issue before them. That doesn't happen in Western religion.
Mm-hmm. 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 They have to risk a lot for the word and all that. Yeah, yeah.
Tripmaster Monkey is a really interesting book, his fake book, story of the 1960s of an interesting guy. Terrific, funny, witty dialogue. It's a terrific book. Maxine Horn Kingston, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Oh, we talked about a lot.
Well, we crammed a lot in there, didn't we?
Yeah.